Welcome, everyone. We're giving everybody just a couple minutes to get upstairs from the big room downstairs, but I think we're going to get started because we are running a little bit late this afternoon. I'm Jan Schwartz. I'm from Oracle Corporation. And I am very excited to say that this is Oracle's first year of sponsoring the conference. We have 70 women with us here today. And I just want to mention that we are a Silicon Valley-based company, and that might come up a little later. So I just wanted to say that there's 70 women from Oracle here today. I'm a senior director of engineering. I've come up through the ranks as a software engineer and now director of engineering. And it's been interesting. The first job that I had in software development was for the U.S. Navy writing sonar system software. And I say that because there weren't many female role models around, as you might imagine. But there was one woman, Stephanie, that worked at the same place that I did. She was about 10 years older than I am. And I realized last night that I can remember Stephanie's name, I can remember her face, I can remember interactions with her, but I couldn't tell you one of the men that I worked with back then. So all of us need our role models, and today, this session, Inspiration to Ignite Your Inner Rebel, comes out of work that has been done by two women who spent some time in Silicon Valley. And they have developed some books and some games for young girls to inspire young girls. And I would like to introduce Francesca, who's here today, one of the authors of the books. And she will tell you about her journey. And hopefully we can all continue our Rebel Girls forward.
Hi. My name is Francesca Cavallo, and with Elena Favilli, I'm the author of a book called Good Night Stories for Rebel Girls. I see some of you nodding. I'm very happy about it. And the co-founder of the company that publishes these books, which is called Timbuktu Labs. Today, I want to tell you the story of how Elena and I went from being two people with $8,000 in our bank account, working from the kitchen of our one-bedroom apartment in Los Angeles, to being New York Times bestselling authors and leaders of a multi-million dollars company with offices in Los Angeles, New York, and London. This story starts in another kitchen, in Milan, in 2011. But before we go any farther, let's just take note of the fact that if Americans start startups in garages, Italians do so in kitchens. So now that you know, back to our story. So it was 2011, the iPad had just come out, and we had this crazy idea of creating an interactive news magazine for kids on the iPad called Timbuktu Magazine. Our goal was to promote imagination as a tool to know the world. We felt that we had a duty to raise children with a passion not just for fantasy stories, but for real stories. We felt it was politically important to raise citizens who find really interesting reality, as much as stories that are fictional. Children, we said, are not citizens of the future. They are citizens of the present, and they should be treated as such. So we put together this crazy magazine. Back then, I was a stage director, and Elena was a journalist. We had no experience whatsoever in the development of apps. But we found this small studio in Madrid who did. So when Elena won a scholarship to develop further this Timbuktu Magazine project, she used that money to hire them, and we got started on this adventure. We launched Timbuktu Magazine on the App Store and learned, after the fact, that it was the first iPad magazine for children to be launched on the iPad. We got great press, and enough compliments and downloads that we thought, let's keep doing this. We learned along the way that what we were doing could be called a startup. It was the very beginning of the startup movement in Italy. So, and remember that we were not coming from a business background or from an engineering background, so this was news to us. I didn't know why at the time anyone would want to put money in a company. But I was in luck, because in Milan, banks are these very big buildings in that, you know, were created in very old places that are very labyrinthic. So whenever you have a meeting with an investor, there is always a junior associate that has to walk you through the halls for like 5-10 minutes before you actually find the office where the meeting is. So I would use those 5 to 10 minutes to understand what the meeting was about. So I would be like, so could you please explain why they would invest money in our company? And they'd be like, to buy equity. And I'd be like, what's equity? And they'd be, it's a portion of your company. And I was like, okay, and what do they want in return? And they were like, they want more money than they invested. And I was like, how much more? Like double? And this guy was like, at least for this kind of investment, at least they want a 7-8x return on the investment that they're making. So I was like, okay, I just need to use the restroom real quick. And in the restroom, I added 10 to all the financial projections of my presentation. So I was a 27-year-old stage director. I knew nothing about projections, about return on investment, about the digital economy, but I sure knew about acting and improvising. So I just used the tools that I had to pretend I was ready for that moment. The first takeaway of this speech is do your best to be prepared, but don't be afraid to improvise. Ellen and I attended many startup events and won a few awards. For one of these awards, they flew us to San Francisco for a month to attend a business gym. An old friend of Elena's agreed to host us in her old house in Berkeley. I had a theater show running that was touring, so I, in a rush, hired my mom as the tour manager, and we left. Within 3 weeks, we had managed to get an introduction to Christine Tsai, the founding partner of 500 Startups. By then, we had 2 issues of Timbuktu magazine out, and we had 60,000 downloads, which back then, believe it or not, was a big deal. The meeting lasted less than half an hour, and a few days later, we got the news that we had been accepted into 500 Startups, and they were going to invest $50,000 in our company. We looked at each other in the back of this cab we were in, and it felt unreal. We didn't know it then, but it was the first of a long series of moments that would feel the same. 500 Startups gave us credibility, and it allowed us to raise a seed round of about $600,000. We assembled a little team and started working on improving the magazine. We worked 14 hours a day. We attended panels, fireside chats with other entrepreneurs, networking events, beer pong sessions. We even went to see Transformers in a movie theater. So the whole Silicon Valley deal. You know, that move had meant many things to me because I wanted to make the most out of it. It meant starting a new professional adventure in a field I knew little about. It meant moving to a place that I had never seen before. And it meant seeing the future. This is what I expected when I moved from Milan to San Francisco and then to Silicon Valley. Silicon Valley, I thought, would be a true meritocracy where people don't look at your gender, but just weigh your ideas and your ability to execute against a vision that needs to be grand enough to inspire the most enlightened group of rich people you've ever met. I learned pretty quickly, first of all, that it wasn't a group of rich people, but a group of rich men, and that changed things. But in it, we accomplished a lot with that first seed run money. We created award-winning apps and reached more than 2 million users. But when we tried to raise more money to scale our company and take it to the next level, something weird happened. Investors started telling us that two girls alone couldn't run the business we imagined, that we couldn't pull it off, that it was a nice lifestyle project, but that people would never take us seriously as entrepreneurs. At first, we thought, it's weird feedback if you have two people in front of you to say that they're alone, because there are at least two. And also, we had a team. But when you receive feedback like this over and over again, you start to doubt yourself. There was something that was holding us back. But what was it? Was it the business we were in? Was it that apps for kids were not as sexy? We weren't quite sure. There was like a big invisible hand that was making moving forward incredibly hard. Then Elena was asked by The Guardian to describe our experience as female entrepreneurs in Silicon Valley. We started thinking to write that article about that comment, two girls alone. We started thinking about all the times we had been told we had balls. Nothing wrong with it, but we don't. We thought about the times we had been approached by investors at startup events, and instead of complimenting our apps, they had complimented our looks. We learned that every year, only 3% of venture capital investment goes to female-funded startups. With that article, we started connecting the dots, angry that it had taken us so long to see what was actually happening. But we weren't the only ones to be angry. When the article was published with the title "Silicon Valley is more Flintstones than Jetsons when it comes to gender equality," comments started to appear too. Some were empathetic, mainly coming from other women who had shared a similar experience. But many were so hateful, we couldn't believe it. There were so many threats that we eventually stopped reading them. It was pretty shocking. Why were all these people so outraged by the fact that we were sharing our experience? Why did they want to deny us the right to tell our own story? What tools had we been given to defend ourselves from this situation? We realized that we had grown up in a society which had simply pretended we would never encounter sexism. As kids, the vast majority of the books we read didn't feature any female characters. In school, we studied history as if the world had been made by men and men alone, with women, sure, in the role of nurses or helpers, but never starring any major transition, never leading any epic battle. Through fairy tales like Cinderella, Snow White, Beauty and the Beast, we and those commenters had been both taught that pride and arrogance are the worst qualities in a woman, that only men can be brave and save the day, and that you have to be pure and sweet to be celebrated as a woman, that you should never complain. So we started thinking, could we create a new kind of fairy tale? Could we arm parents with stories that can inspire their daughters to embrace their ambition and fully explore their potential? A title came to mind, Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls, a collection of bedtime stories about the life and adventures of 100 real women from around the world who defied expectations and made the impossible possible. A nightly meditation for the whole family on the contribution of women to the history of the world. We launched it as a newsletter, sending these little stories to 25 of our friends. They started forwarding these emails to their friends, and eventually we were able to grow the list to 4,000 people. At that point, we said, let's make a book, but let's not ask any gatekeepers to publish it. Let's try and find money in a different way. Let's turn to crowdfunding. By this point, we had almost run out of investment money. We had to let go all our entire team. It was just the two of us. We moved from Silicon Valley to Los Angeles, and we worked, just the two of us, from the kitchen of our one-bedroom apartment in Venice Beach. We said, okay, let's try this one last thing. If it doesn't work, we'll move back to Italy, live a little bit with our parents, and figure it out. We launched our crowdfunding campaign in April 2016 with a funding goal of $40,000. Instead, we ended up raising $1.2 million from... Thank you. From 20,000 backers coming from 75 countries. Publishers started folding over each other to buy the publishing rights. They counted on the fact that it's supposedly more prestigious to be an author published by a big publishing company than it is to be a so-called self-published author. But we wanted to define our success on our own terms. Plus, we thought, this is the opportunity we've been looking for to build the company that we've always dreamed of. This book will be different, we thought, not just for its content, but also for the way it comes to the world. The campaign ended in May, and we had promised our backers that we would get them the book in time for Christmas. Bear in mind, we had never published a book before. We had no contacts with printers. The book had still to be written, incidentally. We had made apps until that point. So how to ship something physical to 20,000 people in 75 countries was a big mystery. But we built a timeline. We hired a production manager who helped us find the printer. We looked for logistic partners whom I interviewed until I found the one that felt right for us. And we went to Elena's village in Tuscany, and free of distractions, we set a tight writing schedule. On November 11, 2016, just as promised, the books started leaving the warehouses and started to be shipped to our backers around the world. Today, Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls is a book series that has sold more than 3.5 million copies. Thanks. And it's been translated into 47 languages. For context, the Bible is translated in 52 languages. So we still have five to go. The book series in total, through crowdfunding, raised a total of $2.5 million. We are not just the publishers of the book. We also chose to be the exclusive distributors of the book in North America. Basically, no one has ever done in the history of publishing what we're doing on this scale. We have direct relationship with every bookshop that carries our books. And we gather their feedback and their interactions with the readers, of course, together with the interactions that we personally have through our site with the readers, to help serve our community of readers better every day. Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls started the most successful trend in publishing of the last 2 years and paved the way to authors who look for a different relationship with their readers, setting an example of what this can mean. The final takeaway of today is simple, but not easy. In order to accomplish great things, you need to learn how to ask for help. Most of the things Ellen and I created over the past 10 years were born out of conversations between the two of us. In some of these conversations, we started involving more people. We asked for their opinion. We asked for their feedback, and those conversations became bigger and bigger. Sometimes you will get no help. Other times you will find things you didn't know you were looking for. And a few times you will find exactly what you were looking for. Asking for help is not a sign of weakness or failure. It will help sharpen your vision, and it will help you turn that vision into a reality. Our biggest conversation so far is called Rebel Girls, and it's a revolution involving millions of people around the world. Had we not asked for help from our designer friends to put together our first Kickstarter, we could have not created that campaign. If we had not asked for help from our backers, we could have not published Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls. Today, we have a team of 24 rebels working from offices in Los Angeles, New York, London. And at the company that we created, diversity is not an afterthought, but the foundation of all that we do. Being a rebel girl means to find your way to live a life full of passion, meaning, and impact in a world that was designed to keep you out. It means to change this system so that future generations can start from a level play field. It means to believe that the world cannot be better if half its population is held back. I want to leave you today with the dedication that opens our latest book, I Am a Rebel Girl, which is an illustrated journal that will help your daughters and you design their own revolution and develop the mindset they need to lead, to be the leaders of tomorrow. The dedication is, freedom is the destination, and the map is yours to draw. Thank you very much.
We are going to take questions, so if anyone has any questions, there are speakers on both aisles, and please feel free to come up if you've got questions for Francesca.
Hi, Francesca. First off, thank you so much. Incredible presentation, and congratulations to you and your team and all of your incredible and inspiring success. My question has to do with the fact that your book is being distributed all over the world and translated into so many languages. How have you made the book that it's adapted culturally in so many different areas? How do you make a story or tell diverse stories that it would resonate in a lot of different cultures around the world?
I believe that was embedded in the project from the very beginning. We wanted the book to be as diverse as it could possibly be, simply because we wanted every little girl to find a little piece of herself in the book. To achieve that, one of the things we did was we asked 60 female illustrators from all over the world to come and portray these women, because we wanted to show them that women come in many different, you know, shapes, colors, at many different ages. This may sound trivial, but the representation of women in media is very narrow. So I believe because we chose to make the book so diverse from the very beginning, this allowed it to be adaptable to a variety of to many different markets.
Hi. Okay. So one comment, one question. First of all, my daughter and I are both huge fans of your books. Secondly, she asked me if I could talk to you today that she wants a poster to go with the second one, because she loves the poster that goes with the first one. And I bought her the journal. She's
great.
We got it all. Secondly, I work with digital fundraisers and nonprofits that do crowdfunding campaigns every day. And I think your Kickstarter is a real model for building a movement and a community rather than just simply asking for donations. So could you give us maybe your top three tips for running like a successful Kickstarter campaign?
Sure. I would say that in my experience, the biggest mistake when doing, you know, if you work with nonprofits, that's going to be different because we never looked at it from the perspective of a nonprofit. So in my experience is more in that kind of crowdfunding. So for that kind of crowdfunding, so for creative projects or these kind of things, one of the biggest mistakes is to treat it like a charity project. So when you do so, people are less drawn to, you know, to come and pitch in. You have constantly to design, but I think that this is also a good perspective also if you are a nonprofit, but you always have to ask yourself, what value is the backer going to find if they back my campaign? What's in it for them? So what does it say about them? People who back crowdfunding campaign like to be considered trendsetters. So the appeal of having something, of having a story that's related to their contribution. For example, when you get, you know, you give this book for Christmas and you can tell, you know, I didn't buy it at this bookshop. I backed it on Kickstarter. It makes you cooler. So that's, you know, it sounds stupid, but it's actually one of, it's a big drive for people who back campaigns on crowdfunding platforms. So that is one thing. The other thing is that a lot of people make the mistake of launching the campaign and then started thinking, how am I going to bring people to back it? And instead, what Ellen and I did, especially for the first campaign, it was just the two of us, you have to build this domino. And the moment you launch, you like push the first piece, all the rest has to fall in place. But if you haven't built your domino first, and you launch the campaign and nothing happens because no one is ready to write about it, no one is ready to go and pitch it. So you have to understand how you can line up your backers before launching the campaign. And the third thing would be probably to ask yourself, and this is bigger than crowdfunding, if what you're doing is connected to a deeper why of your, why are you the right person to do whatever you're doing? So what is your passion there? It took some time for Ellen and myself to understand what exactly we was making us more passionate than anything else. We knew that it was something related to children, so we started producing innovative content for children. But then to realize that girls and girls' empowerment was our biggest driver, it took a lot of work and a few years. So be patient would be the other, with yourself and with the fact that your head has its time to understand things.
Thank you so much. Thank you.
Hi, Francesca. Thank you so much for taking the chance and putting it out there. I come from a bit of a global background, even though I'm Irish. I'm married to an Indian man, and I have two daughters, 12 and 14. And I love this concept because I would always go digging for stories that included them. So my question is, you know, American women, we're still not on an equal playing field, but I think broader into the world. And do you have any plans for kind of reaching out into the different countries and creating stories for those girls?
Well, this is our plan in action. So when we know that, when I see the covers of Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls in all these different languages, and I imagine families around the world reading the stories that we wrote in so many different languages and meditating on, you know, the contributions that women made to the history of the world in so many different contexts. We believe that this is the battle. So we are fighting it, and we are constantly looking for ways. Like, for example, this year in March, we launched a podcast. The first season is 11 episodes. It's some of the stories from book one and from Goodnight Stories for Rebel Girls 2. And it's in a slightly longer format. And we, you know, in that case, we made those stories accessible for free. And we had a tremendous success. It was the first time that we produced a podcast, and it was nominated by Time Magazine, one of the 50 best shows of 2018. We got a People's Choice Award nomination, and we've charted in 6 different countries. So we are constantly looking for ways to bring these stories to our community in all sorts of ways.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
Hi. I think it's just so important that you're rewriting the narrative of the fairy tale with the female hero. And I'm wondering if you've thought about ways. I think it's equally important that boys hear that rewritten narrative of female heroes. So I'm wondering if there's going to be a book for boys with the female stories, because I wanted to buy this book for my nephew, but it says for rebel girls, so I don't think he'll read it because it says that. Do you know what I mean? So, like, I think it's important for boys to hear that those messages too, so they can look to women as heroes.
I will answer with a story. I have a friend who is, comes from Sri Lanka, and she's a big feminist. And when she had a daughter 5 years ago, she was all like, I'm going to buy all gender-neutral clothing. So when we bought, you know, presents for her, I shopped from the girl aisle and from the boy aisle. And, you know, everything was super cool, and we felt like we were the coolest people in the world not buying gendered clothing for her daughter. Then, 2 years ago, she had a boy. And I consider myself a feminist, and I couldn't bring myself to shop in the girl aisle for a boy. And I was like, what is wrong with me? I still have such a negative bias associated with stuff for girls that I believe her boy is going to be diminished by if I buy him something for girls. So this title that we chose is, of course, a provocation. And it's an invite for all the boys that are reading these stories, because they are, and they want to read it, that they shouldn't be ashamed of reading something that reads for girls in the title. The reason why we have not called these goodnight stories about rebel girls, for example, is that, first of all, this book is not just about rebel girls. This book is about life. It's about love. It's about work. So it's not just about girls. And secondly, because there is nothing wrong if there is one thing that we have. And boys are welcome to come and read these stories and not be in the dedication, not be in the title, and, you know, be guests in this book. So if you're thinking of buying this for a boy, I strongly recommend you overcome the fear that I had, and you do it, because this is how we change this system.
Thank you.
And I wanted to say thank you, because I am the mother of 2 boys. I do not have any girls, but we have your books and we read them. My boys are 11 and 9 years old, and they adore your books. And it's actually probably the only book that we actually sit down together and read just one-on-one with each of my boys, because we adore them so much. So thank you. Thank you for that.
Thank you. Yeah. Thank you.
And my question as a fellow creative is, I'm just, I'd love to hear a little bit more about the process of working with the illustrators that you did. I heard you say that you worked with, you know, many different illustrators, and I'd love to know why you made that choice to work with several rather than just keep to one illustrator throughout the whole book, and anything else you'd like to share in, from the design standpoint.
Sure. Well, you know, one of the reasons was that we wanted this book to be a platform for to elevate female talent. And we've always been very passionate about illustration. So we wanted these portraits to be illustrated by many different artists. Of course, there are a few challenges that are associated with that, because we didn't want the book to look schizophrenic, which is, you know, when you work with 60 different artists, is a problem. So part of the research was to pair the right illustrator with the right woman. And part of it was done, who's the artist who can really help us celebrate this face based on their style, based on the place they come from. The other thing was that we did a thorough photographic research for the women, and we went to the illustrators with a portrait in mind that they needed to use as a reference. So we kind of gave them strict guidelines so that we could hold together all these different styles and, you know, make it beautiful and recognizable as one single book, but also as diverse as it could possibly be. It's been, you know, it is challenging, but it's a big part of the identity of our brand, and we feel that there cannot be true diversity if you don't show kids that they can look different, especially girls, that they can look in many different ways and still be okay. We feel this is one of the core messages that we need to pass on to the next generations. And this was the best way that we found to convey that message.
Thank you.
So, sorry. I would like to apologize. I thought you were done speaking, so I like jumped up here. But no, I have two questions for you, actually. And yes, thank you for sharing your story, because it's quite inspiring. First question is, what happened with the Child News app? Did that just fall flat?
Or is with it still the what,
going?
Sorry?
The app that you first created for news for children.
Oh, Timbuktu Magazine. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah.
And then my second question is, are you hiring? What? Are you hiring?
Am I married?
No. Hiring.
Woo! That escalated quickly.
That would be very, very forward.
I'm sorry. I still couldn't hear you.
Oh, are you hiring?
Oh, hiring. Okay, less exciting. Yes, we are hiring. And no, I'm not married. And what happened to Timbuktu Magazine? Timbuktu Magazine had to be sidelined at one point because it wasn't growing at the pace that we needed it to grow. So when the book came about, we had already decided to pause the publication of new issues because it was draining a lot of resources, and we had to make the hard decision that we went to kind of this survival mode, and we tried to keep as lean as we possibly could until we figured out something that could save our company. So for the moment, we paused it. We don't exclude trying again in the future, but for the moment, we're focused on Rebel Girls.
Fair. So. Thank you.
That's okay. So as I read the book with my daughter, I was so surprised by how many of these stories I had never heard. You know, I'd read with her, and then she'd go to bed, and I'd go and look up on my phone real pictures of these women, read their stories. So I'd love to hear just a little bit more about your process of how you kind of whittled down the list of stories that you could have told to the, I guess, 200 that you've told now.
Yes, sure. Well, we used a few main criteria. One was that we wanted the book to feature women from as many careers as possible. The other one was that we wanted to feature women from as many countries as possible. The third one was that we wanted to feature women from the past and the present because we cared to show that Rebel Girls have always been around us, that they are our mothers, our grandmothers, our daughters, our schoolmates. We wanted to present these women in a very relatable way. And in fact, one of the things that we're most proud of is that when we do book signings with kids, girls come to us and often they tell us, I'm going to be in this book one day, which is really moving. And the other thing was that we wanted to celebrate the work of women. We didn't want to have any saints in the book. this was another criteria, because I don't know about the United States, but for example, in Italy, I think that only 3% of the streets and the squares are titled to women, and of that 3%, 97% is saints. So at least where I come from, you literally have to be a saint in order to be celebrated. So instead, we wanted to celebrate the work of women. And the other criteria was that we wanted these, we never wanted this to be an encyclopedia for kids. We wanted these to be real bedtime stories. So in some cases, there were women whom we admired a lot, but we couldn't find an angle to build a good bedtime story around her life. So we left it out. So we wanted this book, all 100, 200 stories, to be strong, enjoyable bedtime stories, inspiring. And we looked for this central image around which we could build the stories. And when we didn't find it, we left the story out. So it was, you know, brutal, but it helped to narrow down the list. Thank you all, and I hope to see you at the book signing.